The Tom Woods Show, episode 2208.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined once again by our friend Dan McCarthy, who, in addition to editing Modern Age, the venerable periodical, and having his great Spectator column and all the other things he does, he is the author of a very substantial foreword to an old post-war conservative classic in America, The Conservative Affirmation by Wilmore Kendall, published in a special edition, Gateway Editions of Regnery, which is, of course, our sort of mutual friend, been published with Regnery a number of times. And I wanted to talk about this book with Dan because Kendall is a key figure in the history of post-war conservatism. And yet, for a number of reasons Dan discusses in the foreword, he's not maybe as well-known as he might otherwise be. And he doesn't have, let's say, a school of thought associated with him or a bunch of followers he specifically cultivated. That just wasn't the way he operated. But he has an interesting book, and we're going to talk about it today. So, Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. I'm delighted to join you.
All right. Obviously, we could take this in a lot of different directions because this is not, as is obvious from glancing at it, a step-by-step building of a philosophical edifice. This is a series of chapters that deal with a variety of self-contained topics, more or less. So we could take one of these and have the whole episode be about that. But what I want to do, first of all, is maybe the very, very beginning, maybe just enough biographical information about Kendall so we can kind of sink our teeth into the book a little bit. And then I want to talk about his discussion of what conservatism is.
Sure. Well, Wilmore Kendall was born to a blind preacher in Oklahoma back in 1909. And of course, the state of Oklahoma was fairly new as a state in the Union at that point. And it was still, you know, in some ways, culturally at least, kind of the Wild West. And you had a lot of small towns in Oklahoma that were really fending for themselves, not in the, you know, sort of stereotypical Hollywood sense of being lawless, but just that they were small communities that were being formed for the first time, and they really had to look out for themselves in a variety of ways. So they had to, you know, be very self-sufficient, and people had to be very industrious in terms of helping their neighbors and creating communities where there had not been any in the past. And as a boy, Wilmore Kendall, you know, used to visit Oklahoma City from time to time, and that really was, you know, sort of maybe a combination of what we think of as the Wild West, and in a kind of minor way, what we think of perhaps as a gangster movie as well. I'm dramatizing a little bit, but basically Oklahoma City back in the early 1900s was a pretty rough and tumble place. And young Wilmore Kendall enjoyed getting into a little bit of trouble back then in Oklahoma City. So he had this, you know, Oklahoma background. You know, even back then, it was a state that elected Democrats, but it was basically what we would now call a red state, culturally speaking. It was very much not on the map of, you know, sort of the East Coast establishment. Nevertheless, Wilmore Kendall was absolutely brilliant. In fact, he was kind of a child prodigy, although that wound up being a rather mixed blessing, because when you're a child prodigy and you get admitted to college at a very early age, you're just not emotionally mature or socially mature enough to interact with the other college students.
Yeah, he was 13.
He was 13.
Of course,
yeah.
That's not going to work out.
And in addition to that, his father had kind of manipulated his fame. So Wilmore Kendall was, you know, quite brilliant, you know, in his own right. But his father did indeed sort of polish up or even write some of his college application essays and other work. So as a result, you know, Wilmore Kendall genuinely was a child prodigy, but he was also one who was, you know, sort of turned into a marketing tool by his father in some ways. And so he wound up having a kind of checkered undergraduate career, but then ultimately went on to gain a PhD. He went on to study at Oxford University and became, you know, a kind of leading intellectual in American life in the 1940s and 1950s, so much so that he even got an appointment at Yale University. And he very rapidly became the least popular person in the Yale Department of Government because he didn't really disguise what had become by that point his conservative leanings. Although he didn't really begin as a conservative. You began as a populist, as an Oklahoma kid who, you know, had this kind of a small town ethos. But in the environment of the early 20th century, you know, a lot of these small town Oklahoma kids, they got convinced that socialism was kind of the natural direction populism should take. And as Wilmore Kendall went through his educational experience, you know, he encountered professors who in many cases were either socialists or outright communists. And so some of that rubbed off on Wilmore Kendall early on. So for a time, you know, he was himself something of a loose devotee of Trotskyism. You know, he had this communist period, or at least fellow traveler period, I should say, in the same way that a lot of intellectuals of that period did as well. But he shook it off over the course of the Second World War. And he really not only returned to a kind of fundamentally culturally conservative disposition, but one that really became deeply rooted in the idea of America as a contrast to the kind of tyranny that you find in the Soviet Union, and indeed the kind of tyranny that even what passes for liberalism today has tried to build in our country.
Now I want to talk about his chapter, What is Conservatism? Because this is a great question I love to talk about under any circumstances. Russell Kirk says conservatism is not an ideology, but then he does proceed to lay out in the conservative mind, these are nevertheless a number of features that we associate with conservatism, certain leanings, certain prejudices, certain inclinations. And Kendall says, now, when we're trying to figure out what conservatism means, there are people who want us to be able to just draw a line, and there'll be some people on one side of the line and other people on the other side of the line. So the line could be the free enterprise economy. And he says that's maybe what Murray Rothbard or Ayn Rand would want us to say. And then it's very easy to decide who's on one side of that line, who's on the other. We could also draw the line and have it represent religious affirmations of various kinds, but that wouldn't quite work because there were certainly secular people we would call conservatives and religious people we would call on the left. So that one doesn't work. So he goes through a number that he finds unsatisfactory until he settles on one. And I'd like to read just a short passage here where he says, we stand in the presence of a liberal revolution. That revolution is a revolution sensu stricto and one that means business. Its purpose is to establish in America, in Machiavelli's phrase, new modes and orders. Conservatism, I am saying, is first and foremost the resistance to that revolution. So I feel like in the expression of that sentiment, that's where I see what Dan McCarthy identifies as Wilmore Kendall as kind of the godfather of right-wing populism today.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, interestingly enough, Wilmore Kendall's getting the inspiration for some of this from Leo Strauss. Some of the listeners to this podcast might be surprised to hear that because, you know, they think of perhaps Leo Strauss as an inspiration to the neoconservatives and to a number of other malefactors in our own time. But Strauss was a very interesting and very brilliant thinker. And Strauss makes this argument that Machiavelli is, in most respects, the founder of modernity, the founder of a move away from a belief in natural rights, in natural right singular, meaning simply that good and evil and right and wrong are things that actually exist in reality and are natural features of, you know, real moral things that are not simply matters of opinion. Machiavelli is, you know, certainly a pivotal figure in moving towards a more instrumental view of right and wrong, or perhaps even ditching the ideas of right and wrong and simply moving towards an instrumental idea of power. So when Wilmore Kendall says that resisting a kind of Machiavellian revolution is what American conservatism is all about, that's what he's getting at. The idea that American conservatism, it may be a little bit vague as to whether it's about natural rights in some particular formulation like Thomism or what have you, or whether it's about religion, or whether it's about natural right in the singular, meaning simply the natural quality of right and wrong. But whatever, you know, position conservatives might take on those particular schools of thought, they're all opposed to the idea there simply is no moral truth whatsoever, and that only, you know, sort of pleasure and convenience are the measures of human well-being. And that is basically, I mean, that's utilitarianism, but it's also fundamentally this kind of moral nihilism Strauss traces to Machiavelli. And the Kendall thought was being basically adopted and promulgated by 20th century liberals.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into what Kendall sees that he's describing as a liberal revolution. So first of all, remind us what year the conservative affirmation is written.
Now, the Conservative Affirmation is written in 1963 at a time when John F. Kennedy is still alive and the Beatles have not yet been on the Ed Sullivan Show. So in that sense, the Conservative Affirmation may seem like a book that is, you know, in some respects, more of the 1950s, even than what we think of in terms of the 1960s with the Vietnam War and student protests and things like that. But in fact, the book is sort of brilliantly anticipatory, and it already identifies the revolution that was underway not only in 1963, but really that Kendall had been aware of, this revolution being underway since the 1950s, really since the end of World War II.
Maybe I'm just so jaded by the events of the past 2, 5, 10, 20 years that when I think about 1963, well, you know, if I had the opportunity to choose, I'd pretty gladly take the America of 1963 without a whole lot of complaint, even though I know that my contrarian nature would identify trends that I don't like, and I certainly would have political stances, and I would understand where things seem to be going, but the vastly worse and grotesquely worse aspects of the so-called liberal revolution hadn't even been born yet. And yet he's already situating conservatism as being fundamentally about standing up to it and opposing it. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I think the book is really far ahead of its time, so much so that it's more relevant today even than it was when it was written in 1963.
So having said that, now I don't know how satisfied I am with this as an overall definition. I mean, maybe it's an interesting working definition, but it can't fundamentally be what conservatism is.
Well, Kendall's talking about American conservatism, and he says, you know, in the beginning of his book, in his introduction, that he's not necessarily trying to define conservatism, you know, once and for all, in all times and all places.
But certainly in this particular set of historical circumstances, this is what conservatism is in America right now. If it's anything, it's this.
I mean, but it's also, I mean, because Kendall has this Oklahoma background, he is thinking very much of the American context. So, I mean, he would actually say, I think, that what he's describing is true for American conservatism, you know, certainly from the founding onwards, perhaps even from the colonial period onwards. And Kendall has another book called The Basic Symbols of the American Political Tradition, which actually looks quite closely at a number of colonial era documents and finds, you know, the beginnings of what you will eventually call American conservatism in those colonial documents. I should say, by the way, that I'm kind of mixing two different categories here. So on the one hand, there is this American tradition that is explored in The Basic Symbols of the American Political Order. And this is basically, Kendall summarizes it as government by deliberation of a virtuous people who are under God. And that's it may seem a little bit arbitrary to frame it in that way, but he has a whole book that explains why those elements come together. That's the American tradition. The American tradition then is subject to derailment by a number of people who make claims that are not compatible with that way of life and the vision that originates from things like the Mayflower Compact, the Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, and ultimately the U.S. Constitution and the Federalists. So Kendall says that this revolutionary period, this liberal revolution that we're living in right now, this is what gives rise to conservatism, because conservatives are the people who rise up to oppose a revolutionary transformation.
He spends quite a bit of time talking about the importance of Congress. Now, this is something that, this is not unique to Kendall. I mean, I can think of quite a few conservatives whose view was that the presidency has grown to an absurd degree in terms of its powers, and it has been eclipsing Congress for quite some time. And, you know, there are many examples of this, obviously, when it comes to war powers, but also, let's say, with some of the controversy surrounding some of the so-called signing statements under George W. Bush. And then we have some of the doctrines we see coming out of John Yoo about the presidency. So that's not entirely unique to Kendall, but his affection for Congress seems to be linked to his populism, because he thinks of Congress as being the branch closest to the people, and he trusts the people more than he trusts the elites. So am I more or less on the right track?
Absolutely. So Kendall is arguing in favor of self-government at the local level, and he sees the national government as being derived from that self-government at the local level. Some of Kendall's critics, such as Harry Jaffa, who, of course, was the West Coast Chaucerian, quite famous for writing books like Crisis of the House Divided about Abraham Lincoln and Lincoln-Douglas debates. Harry Jaffa would sometimes caricature Wilmore Kendall as being a advocate of John C. Calhoun's ideas or as being a kind of Confederate sympathizer. And this is actually quite wrong. Kendall was, in fact, very Madisonian, and he really believed in a strong relationship between local self-government and national government. So he was not as much of a, you know, supporter of states' rights as the Jaffaite view of him might suggest, but he was very much a believer that, you know, Congress, in order to be an effective institution, in order to be an institution that represented the real spirit of the American people, had to be something that was grounded in that tradition of local self-government in the congressional district level and at the state level. And Kendall was, he has this great chapter in the Conservative Affirmation called The Two Majorities, where he's talking about the difference between a congressional majority, which really is the aggregate of these local forms of self-government and, you know, sort of local understandings of how to instantiate the proper understanding of right and wrong, you know, working that up from the local level all the way through to the federal level. He compares that kind of majoritarianism, where it's, you know, state by state, congressional district by congressional district, versus the kind of majoritarianism you get at the presidential level. And of course, we still do have the Electoral College, but the left is trying to get rid of the Electoral College. And that was true even back in Wilmore Kendall's day, and he writes about that. What the left wants, what liberals want, modern liberals, is a national plebiscite where, you know, everyone all votes in one big election, and then whoever wins that big election gets all power and gets to do whatever they want. And Kendall, you know, he has very, you know, sort of brilliant insights into the different styles of politics and the different sort of ramifications of these two different kinds of majorities. And he notes that if you're going for this presidential majority where you're trying to get an entire nation, a majority of, you know, a nation of 300 million people now to support a particular program or a particular candidate, the program and the candidate are going to have to be very vague. They're going to have to make promises that they won't be able to deliver. They're going to have to, you know, describe things in such a general fashion that they will, you know, sort of be acting upon people's emotions. Whereas when you have congressional candidates in congressional districts, they have to know something about their district and they have to know something about the particular people and the particular industries and interests that exist within that district. And so even at the level of rhetoric, you get a very different kind of thing at the presidential level versus at the congressional level. Unfortunately, I think Congress has had a lot of changes that have been changes for the worse in the time between Kendall's day and our own. And of course, the presidency has only grown far more powerful. And we've had a lot of, you know, sort of forces that have nationalized politics in our time. So one of the key questions that I think people who come to the Conservative Affirmation today need to ask themselves is whether what Kendall's describing as the American system of government, this congressional majoritarian system, is still recoverable. And if it's not recoverable, then do we have to, you know, put our chips into trying to create a right-wing version of this presidential majoritarianism? Or do we have to consider other kinds of alternatives? I think one of the great values of this book is that it, you know, sort of helps us to understand and analyze some of the most profound choices that face us in terms of our constitutional order.
Incidentally, I can't help noting, having read your foreword, I think you say something along the lines of, I think Buckley became kind of tired of him after a while, partly because of his attitude and the way he treated other thinkers and scholars. I mean, I personally feel like I'm seeing that later in the book when he's reviewing Richard Weaver's Ideas Have Consequences. Now, I'll grant you, Ideas Have Consequences is an idiosyncratic book, and it's not for everybody, and maybe his thesis is wrong, but it's the kind of book that makes you think about important things. And the way Kendall treats, I mean, I feel like he talks down to him in the entire review of that, you know, somewhat seminal book. And I thought, well, if that's what Buckley is responding to, then maybe I understand why Kendall wasn't winning popularity contests.
Yeah, Kendall had a reputation for being a rather disputatious individual and rather difficult to get along with. That said, and I should mention, by the way, because listeners will find this to be an unexpected quality of the Conservative Affirmation, but there are several main chapters in the Conservative Affirmation. And then the last third or so of the book consists of a number of book reviews. And that may seem kind of surprising, you know, just as a format for a book. But actually, I mean, the book reviews are very interesting. And they allow Kendall to get into, you know, particular aspects of other thinkers, people like Richard Weaver, you know, Leo Strauss, and a number of others, and also to talk about a wide variety of topics. And there are consistent threads through these reviews, but it is certainly a format of a book that one will find rather surprising. It's actually based upon the format of Leo Strauss's book, What is Political Philosophy? And originally, Kendall was going to call his book, What is Conservatism?
Right. And said, I guess he was talked into making naming chapter one that and going with the conservative affirmation. So let's go to another one of those main chapters, though. I personally find the topics chosen for those main chapters to be, to return to the word idiosyncratic, I think precisely that. So the subject of the social contract comes up. Now, a book for which I myself wrote the foreword, The American Republic by Orestes Brownson, has a series of very, very strong arguments against social contract theories, and I think fatally strong arguments against them. But of what practical importance is it whether or not conservatives believe in a social contract theory of society?
Yeah, I should probably refer to Kendall's other book, The Basic Symbols of the American Political Tradition. What Kendall ultimately comes to is a theory in which, and he's drawing in part on Eric Voegelin, by the way, whose ideas are perhaps even more difficult to summarize. But basically, Eric Voegelin talks about how one of the things that constitutes a polity, whether we're talking about a city state or a nation state, or for that matter, even a polity that's still rather loosely organized, like a tribe, for example, like ancient Israel, these polities, however they are organized, are all a way in which a people understands its place in relationship to the transcendent. And the basic symbols, and again, these are Voegelinian terms, they are the ways in which a people understands its place in eternity in a way, or at least, you know, what it means to be organized as the Israelites or to be organized as the city of Athens, in our case, to be organized as the United States of America. And Kendall says that basically the tradition that we've had from the Mayflower Compact onwards has been a tradition, I mean, it actually antedates both John Locke and Thomas Hobbes. So it's a tradition of a social contract, but it's a different kind of social contract than what most social contract theorists talk about. So most social contract theorists, you know, from Hobbes to Locke onwards, they are thinking of a social contract that creates the community in the first place. And the implication tends to be that the social contract is also creating the basic values of right and wrong that the society has. Both Locke and Hobbes are somewhat evasive on that point. You know, in Locke, you know, he asserts that there actually are, you know, very strong natural laws that both antedate and continue to survive after the creation of the political state. But, you know, there's a variety of schools of thought which say that most social contract theorists are not really serious about that, that once you have the creation of the state through the social contract, everything is then on the table. And what Kendall is saying is that actually a social contract can be a specifying contract rather than an originating contract. And so the specifying contract basically says we're not creating right and wrong. What we're doing is we are saying this is how we decide on questions of right and wrong underneath, you know, the supreme judge, underneath God, basically, as that source of right and wrong. So it's the way in which we operationalize or implement in a very broad way how we go about, you know, sort of following the sense of right and wrong that doesn't simply originate with us. And so he sees ultimately the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, as being expressions of this, just as the Mayflower Compact and the fundamental orders of Connecticut and other founding documents of the colonial period were. So it's a view of a social contract that's actually quite different from what most people would think of in terms of the social contract tradition. And I fear that I'm not giving a truly, you know, persuasive account of it in a few minutes here. But all I can say is that you'll be fascinated by what you find, both in the conservative affirmation and in basic symbols. And Kendall has thought these questions through very carefully with a very sharp skeptical mind. He's looked at the sort of bromides that come from people who've, you know, imbibed a lot of Rousseau and who've imbibed a lot of other sort of more recent 18th, 19th, 20th century social contract theory. And Kendall, you know, sort of provides a toolkit for dissecting and analyzing a lot of the mistakes that some of these thinkers make. I should mention, by the way, Kendall was a, had a very keen understanding of Rousseau, and he translated both Rousseau's Social Contract, the book, and also Rousseau's Constitution of Poland, which is another very interesting text.
I realize I was kind of asking a lot by taking a rather obscure topic and just lobbing it at you, but I found it to be illustrative of the book at large, that suddenly I'm presented with this profound question kind of out of nowhere after the previous chapter. But I'm going to throw another one at you. And this one's also difficult, but I think as the host of a libertarian podcast, I have certain obligations to the listening audience. And I think we need to take a few minutes to reckon with the chapter, Conservatism and the Open Society. and open society in quotation marks. He's referring to Karl Popper's book there. And here he's taking on John Stuart Mill, my least favorite classical liberal, who famously advocated, he advocated all kinds of horrible things too, but he advocated free speech and free thought. And Kendall seems to say that under certain circumstances, he could see supporting that, but he refuses to believe that it could be an absolute. So can you take his thesis and make it accessible to us?
Yes, and in fact, that's one of the key themes throughout the Conservative Affirmation. And you also find in parts of the Conservative Affirmation, Wilmore Kendall goes into detail about Joseph McCarthy. Of course, Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s was famous or infamous for looking for communists within the federal government. And McCarthy was accused of exaggerating these claims. And in fact, he did exaggerate many of them. And it was understood that McCarthy and sort of the larger anti-communist red hunting phenomenon of which McCarthy became a symbol, which also included, for example, Richard Nixon and various other figures investigating communist infiltration in Hollywood and things like that. This was turned into, this whole McCarthyite episode was turned into a test of free speech in America. And Wilmore Kendall, I think, very accurately perceived that the fundamental question here wasn't just about, you know, sort of rights. It wasn't just about whether particular claims being made by McCarthy were correct or not. But it was rather, you know, does a society of any kind have a right to defend itself? And in defending itself, to draw certain limits as to what, you know, members of that society may do. And if there is no such right to defend itself, then the society will ultimately collapse and it will be consumed by the people who want to destroy it. So when it's put in the context of McCarthy, when it's put in the context of free speech, people's natural civil libertarian inclinations look at this and they're naturally horrified. They say that, well, you're talking about censorship. You're talking about who knows what measures you want to take, you know, against people who have communist views or people who have views that are antithetical to America or that you think are antithetical to America. Who are you to judge, you know, what speech is right and wrong and so forth? But if you think about it, I mean, what Kendall is fundamentally saying here, it's something that libertarians themselves understand very well when it's applied to private spaces. So if, for example, you own a Walmart or you own a shop of any kind, and you generally, you know, you're not policing your customers' speech. You don't care if your customers are discussing, you know, what they want to buy as they're in your shop or whatnot. But if you suddenly started having a lot of people coming to your store and they were constantly saying, oh, this store is terrible. We want to have, you know, everyone should be shopping at another store. This store should close down. This store should be looted because it's, you know, perpetuating injustice or something. You would be perfectly in your rights as a store owner to kick those people out of your store. You know, it doesn't mean that you want to police or, you know, micromanage people's conversations in your store. It just means fundamentally, your store can't exist if it's going to play host to people who are trying to destroy it. And that applies to any kind of association whatsoever, including political associations. And so, you know, if you have people who really do want to destroy your society, who are constantly aiming to undermine the values that make it possible and the ideas that make it possible, you're going to have to, you know, tell them to shut up, put them in jail, do whatever you have to do in order to preserve your society. And again, civil libertarians hearing that are going to immediately think, well, this is an extremely heavy-handed thing for the state to be doing. Kendall is certainly not averse to using state power in these kinds of ways, but I don't think one has to understand Kendall's argument as being fundamentally about one mechanism or another, whether it's state power or whether it's, you know, private institutions that are engaged in this limitation of subversive behavior. And Kendall is also, I mean, you have to read it, you know, sort of carefully, and you have to, you know, take note of what he says and not just, you know, sort of be so outraged by his criticism of the open society that you miss what he says about philosophy. But Kendall actually does say that, yes, a society absolutely needs people who can freely discuss even the most fundamental questions that, you know, might cast into doubt the sanctity of the city itself or the sanctity of private property rights or any number of other things. There's a reason why philosophers and, you know, sort of other people at a pretty high level have to be free to do this. But that freedom among philosophers has to be handled by them responsibly. And it is not something which you can generalize to, you know, every would-be vandal and, you know, sort of lunatic without having your society or having your, you know, again, your shop that you might own being completely destroyed. So I think that, you know, people should read Kendall carefully and think not just about how shocking some of his statements are, but about how what he's actually saying is common sense when you apply it in context, you know, that you're comfortable with and accustomed to, and that, you know, these questions do apply to the public sphere as well. And it seems to me that Kendall, you know, in practice, he might actually have been rather more open about speech than his chapter might lead one to believe. But his point was that, you know, there has to be a way to draw a line eventually. Otherwise, the people who want to destroy things will succeed in destroying them.
Before I go on, let me say a quick thing that will help a lot of you, and you know who you are. If you are in business and you're getting buried by your competition online, then build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO, our great sponsor. If you're a small local business, you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry, increase your visibility with Persist SEO. Or if you have low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis, well, website search engine and conversion optimization can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. If you're tired of cold calling, use your website as a lead generation engine. If you're not showing up for your services on the search engines, then get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help.
Let me read you a passage now, just for fun, because why not? From one of the, maybe you've read this too, but it's one of the memos that Murray Rothbard wrote for the Volcker Fund in the 60s. Because he wrote a series of memos he was paid to write, usually about new books. So here's something he says about Kendall. And I'd just like to get your thought. I mean, Rothbard's not infallible. I just want to get your thoughts. So he says, we should now face the question, how does Kendall differ, say, from Russell Kirk? Why is he anti-Kirk, as he is reputed to be, even though both of them unite in being opposed to free speech and Mills on Liberty? Answer, there is great difference between them. Kirk is the philosopher of old pre-industrial revolution, high Anglican England, the land of the squire, the church, the happy peasant, and the aristocratic bureaucratic caste. He is essentially and basically anti-democratic. Kendall, on the contrary, is, as I have said, the pattern of the lynch mob. He is an ur-democrat, a Jacobin impatient of any restraints on his beloved community. He hates bureaucracy, but not as we do because it is tyrannical. He hates it because it has usurped control from the popular masses. He is the sort of person whom the Rossiter-Viereck new conservatives are combating, for they are trying to defend the existent rule of the leftist bureaucracy against any populist mass upheaval. Well, what do you say?
Well, several things. First of all, I think, you know, without Rothbard referencing Kendall here or being consciously, you know, aware of this, but I think Rothbard ultimately wound up adopting something much more like Kendall's own views, not necessarily, you know, as articulated or as channeled in the ways that Rothbard would channel them. But Rothbard himself, of course, became, I think it's fair to say, a libertarian populist. And he really did trust the American people far more than the elites with making the right decisions. Now, obviously, Rothbard's an anarchist. He doesn't want to make those decisions using the state, but he certainly thinks that the people and the people's, you know, sort of private decisions about what's right and what's wrong and kind of where to draw the limits in, you know, political correctness and other things, that the people are more trustworthy there than the intellectuals. So in that sense, I think Rothbard ultimately started to come around more towards Kendall's side. And in some ways, perhaps he was always on Kendall's side, but the way in which Kendall expressed himself caused that to be less clear. I do want to take issue with one thing that Rothbard says. Actually, maybe I'll first make an ironic observation, which is also that there's a little bit of an overlap between Rothbard's criticism of Kendall and Harry Jaffa's criticism of Kendall, because they both are worried about the idea that Kendall is throwing out any concern with fundamental right and wrong, is just saying whatever the masses want, whatever the public wants, whatever the majority wants is good. So it becomes might makes right. That was always Harry Jaffa's fundamental criticism, not only of Kendall, but also of Calhoun and of, you know, the Confederacy and so forth. And then, you know, Rothbard uses the term masses, and that's not a term that Kendall would accept. So what Kendall argues, and I think very effectively in the conservative affirmation, is that you don't want to have the masses, you know, sort of rallied behind, you know, some sort of all-powerful entity. This is what he's describing with the two majorities as the presidential majority. It's exactly the kind of thing he doesn't want to see. What he wants to do is, instead of having the masses, you have to have a American public that is organized into its local communities and into its states. And that is very different. So the localities are not the masses. The masses are something, you know, on a much, much larger level. And within the localities, yes, the localities can certainly make mistakes as to what's right and wrong, but they are less likely to be misled, Kendall thinks, than the intellectuals who are wrapped up in abstractions and who are perhaps seduced by, you know, sort of Machiavellian concepts. So Kendall and I think Rothbard both agree that ordinary American people within their local contexts are more trustworthy than some of the great would-be intellectual shapers of society. And what the problem is, of course, that the great shapers of society want to destroy those local communities, and they've been very successful at doing that in order precisely to create this new sort of undifferentiated mass of the public, which can then be manipulated by abstractions and, you know, sort of channeled into supporting some all-powerful state or some all-powerful, you know, sort of single leader figure, a kind of Caesar.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of my favorite things Rothbard ever wrote, and I'm going to sound like a Philistine saying this after all the important things he wrote, actually was his John Randolph Club speech that I'm sure you must have read, A Strategy for the Right. It is such a pleasure to read that speech, and I've returned to it numerous times. But in that speech, he poses this exact question. And this is a speech that he posed, what, this was a few years before he died. So this is about as mature expression of his thought as we can ask for. And he says that one of the key strategic questions has been, who are the major bad guys we should focus on? Is it the masses or is it the power elite? And he says, very early, I concluded that the big danger is the elite and not the masses, and for the following reasons. And then he just says, look, even if the masses are terrible, most of them have things to do all day. You know, they're not politically organized in a machine 24 hours a day the way the elites are. So that's one reason you don't have to worry about them. And then he had a series of reasons that for whatever areas where the masses might go off the rails, yeah, he's not saying there's one perfect solution to this, but where your instincts go and where if you absolutely had to choose, he's going with the masses. So that it is interesting, isn't it, that he ultimately settles on a position that sounds not a million miles removed from Kendall.
I think that's right. And again, I would just say that I think if the ghost of Kendall were present when Rothbard gave his John Randolph Club speech, that he would probably, you know, sort of raise some objections to the notion of the masses and talk instead about, you know, the American public in its sort of constitutional and sort of state-organized, locally organized forms. And I think that's important. And it's something that I think libertarians actually, again, Wilmore Kendall is not a libertarian. He's not, you know, sort of framing his arguments in terms that libertarians would find, you know, sort of easily emotionally accessible. In fact, quite the opposite. Kendall's always, you know, framing his arguments in ways that I think libertarians will, you know, immediately find outraging. But actually, when you think through what Kendall is saying and how he sees things operating, I think libertarians would actually find an enormous amount of common ground here. So think about this. I mean, as a libertarian, one of the problems you face is that you may have a very strict code of non-aggression against other individuals. You may have a very, you know, sort of enlightened view of what rights individuals have, how people should voluntarily cooperate with one another. One of the problems, of course, however, is that other human beings that you have to deal with in your daily life don't have that same understanding. So that's one of the more fundamental difficulties, not just of politics per se, but of any kind of societies. You're going to have a society that's going to be a mixture of people who may have different intellectual commitments, different understandings of what their rights are, different understandings of the way in which to treat other people. And what do you do in that circumstance? Well, both libertarians, especially realistic libertarians like Murray Rothbard, and I think localist populists like Wilmore Kendall, I think both libertarians and localist populists would say the best thing to do is to treat other people in a neighborly fashion. And, you know, you have to make some concessions to your neighbors. There may be things that, you know, they believe that you don't believe, but, you know, for the sake of getting along together, whether it is in a local government or whether it's in, what do you call the, when a number of local residents, the housing association, right? A homeowners association.
Yeah.
A homeowners association, it may create rules that some individual homeowners don't like, but you all kind of agree that you're part of this community and therefore you're going to have these rules. And it's not a coercion. It's actually part of just what being part of that organization is. Whether you're talking about a state or a voluntary organization, these same problems are going to emerge, but they tend to be problems that are less intense and they're more easily managed at the local level. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that Wilmore Kendall is on the side of whatever a local community wants to do is therefore right. And so when Rothbard says it's kind of the mentality of a lynch mob, and a lynch mob, of course, is a band of local people basically going nuts and committing an injustice against someone, I think Rothbard's wrong to say that Kendall is in favor of lynch mobs or in favor of the mentality of the lynch mob, because Kendall, in fact, does have this very deep commitment to the Federalist Papers and to James Madison. And the idea of federalism precisely working along the lines that Madison proposed, which is that when you bring together all these local interests for a hearing, basically, within Congress, within the legislature, about are the local communities doing the right things? Are the states doing the right things? Are there things that need to be done at a national level? This kind of aggregation of different local communities is a way to reduce any kind of extreme outliers among local communities that are endorsing very unjust and iniquitous policies. And of course, the Constitution itself guarantees a Republican form of government to the states. So Kendall is not, as Harry Jaffa had argued, a kind of Confederate apologist or even a Calhounian. Kendall is someone who really is devoted to this Madisonian idea of local self-government, but with some controls that come from the aggregate of local self-governments at the federal level. Of course, what we have now is something where the national government is not simply acting as an aggregate of the localities. Instead, it's trying to act, as basically a philosopher king, and the philosophy that animates the king, the philosophy that animates the administrative state is this modern liberalism that Wilmore Kendall recognized as being a revolutionary coup within our form of government.
Well, the book we've been discussing, of course, is The Conservative Affirmation by Wilmore Kendall, featuring a very, very nice foreword by Dan McCarthy. And as a matter of fact, when we combine the foreword, then the preface, then there's an introduction, by the time you get to chapter one, I feel like I've read 65 pages, but it's quite a book. I'm very glad you urged me to read it. I forgot. I've written notes on the very back page. I just found them. But it turns out I've more or less referred to them all anyway in our conversation. So I'm going to link in particular to make sure, of course, the original version is no doubt long out of print, but just to absolutely 100% make sure people pick it up with Dan's foreword, they get the right edition, I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2208. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.